traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Okay, Eric Chung, you are the CIO of Lighthaven Capital Management. And we talk on this podcast a lot about investing strategies. One thing we don't talk about, because it's too complex and too difficult and I don't have the math background, is algorithms, machine learning, big data, NLP, which I believe stands for neuro-linguistic processing, if I'm not mistaken. But these are all buzzwords that have kind of worked their way into the common parlance of investment management, especially at hedge funds these days. And it's almost become a cliche to the point where virtually every hedge fund has something in the way of big data, machine learning, NLP, algorithms. Algorithms are a big one. And the view is that this, all these things, driven by computers, by computer power, gives the investment manager an edge over the competition. And now your views on this are contrarian because you don't believe it. Is that correct? And tell me more.
Yeah, sure. And I'll be, you know, upfront. I'm not a big data expert. I'm not a computer scientist. I will say that I do have an unpopular view that I think that not only algorithms, but also financial models and just the widespread use of math in the investment management industry is, while it can be helpful, and I'd like to talk about all the areas where it can help a manager, I think that there's been some pretty significant over-reliance on those things. I think they're useful tools, but I don't think they're sufficient for investing success.
Okay. Can you give some examples of areas where we've seen it to be over-reliant to the point where it becomes a detriment to the strategy?
Sure. You know, I first started focusing on this issue a couple of decades ago. I think most of us will remember the downfall and the implosion of long-term capital management. Mm-hmm. So that was a very big news at the time. This was in the mid to late 90s. And an algorithmic strategy, the fund itself was actually run by a number of Nobel laureates. They had more mm-hmm. than one, I believe. I think they had two. So very much in the vein of, you know, relying on algos and computers and math to drive the investing process. More recently, in the late 2000s, the global financial crisis. A lot of people may still remember that in the 2000s, quant funds were very popular, were all mm-hmm. the rage. And during the global financial crisis, a lot of them unceremoniously shut down because the results that they promised people didn't materialize. And when the GFC happened, they didn't perform as expected. And what's ironic is, you know, 2020 rolls around after the longest bull market ever, more than 10 years, and it doesn't seem like much has changed. Mm. In Q1 of 2020, during the COVID-19 market crash, we see something very similar happening, where this time it's a number of very large hedge funds, as well as some robo-advisors that use a strategy called risk parity. And a lot of these funds have marketed this as an all-weather strategy. Unfortunately, it didn't protect the investors when the storm came.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've c- covered the hedge fund industry for about the entire time that you mentioned, going back to the early 2000s. And to your point, I know that quant investing is not new at all. It was big in the mid-2000s. It was big in the early 2010s. It's big now. But what is it, you think, about these strategies that they get wrong?
Yeah, I'd like to dive a little bit deeper later into risk parity specifically, because it's fresh on everybody's mind. But I think that the over-reliance on math, financial models, algorithms, computers generally, it stems from some biases that we have. Mm-hmm. The reality is, as human beings, we all hate uncertainty. We would all like, you know, things to be neat and clean. We like things in black and white. The unfortunate thing is that the markets aren't like that.
Yeah.
And so I think that one of the things that's happening here is that a lot of really smart people are subject to the man with a hammer tendency. What I'm referring to is something that Charlie Munger, the vice chairman of Berkshire Hathaway, talks about quite a bit. And that is, he likes to say, and I think this may be an old Japanese saying, but he didn't invent this saying, but you know, with a man, to a man with a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
Right.
And you know, you've got some really smart computer scientists, mathematicians, Nobel laureates, you know, people who are experts in economics, very strong in econometrics and other types of math, that are able to digitize investing, to bring clarity to something that's inherently very messy. Mm-hmm. And that's very alluring, that's very attractive. But unfortunately, I don't think that you know, we're at the point today in 2020 where our models, the algorithms that we've developed, are good enough to solve for investing. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, there are a couple of observations I would make. The first is that, you know, computers have done a great job in certain areas. If you look at games, you know, for a long time, you know, IBM has created a computer that can beat, you know, the best chess players in the world. More recently, Go, they solved for Go. You know, these are impressive achievements. And again, I think there's a place for technology. There's a place for math. There's a place for financial models. What I would point out is that these games are ones where information is, where there's perfect information, where the very things that computers are really good at, you know, brute force computations, being tireless, being able to churn through gazillions of permutations and combinations of moves, you know, these are the things that computers excel at and are far better than human beings at. So it's not a surprise to me that it can think many more moves ahead of Garry Kasparov and beat him at chess, or it can beat you know, the world's best Go player. But when you look at something a little bit more more complicated, something where there isn't perfect information, a game like poker as an example, my understanding is that recently there was a computer that was able to beat a world-class poker player one-on-one with this game. But to my knowledge, we haven't developed the artificial intelligence, the algo, the computer science to beat, you know, a table of professional world-class poker players like Phil Ivey, you know, at the World Series of Poker. And I think the reason is that like investing in the markets, poker is a game of imperfect information. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more, there's a lot of unknowns. There's a lot of deception in poker. There are human elements that a computer or any participant in the markets, or in the game rather, in the poker game, must understand. So it's not just a simple matter of pattern detection or crunching numbers. And I bring that up because, you know, the problem with our reliance on algorithms, financial models, and math generally is you've got to believe a couple of things. If you're a proponent of basically just letting go of the wheel and letting the computers drive investment decisions, the first thing that you've got to believe is that historical data basically predicts the future. So, of course, there's, you know, there's a lot of information out there. With the exception of forecasts, I would argue that all data is historical. And so Warren Buffett, to quote another Berkshire Hathaway executive, says that relying on historical data to make investment decisions is kind of like driving a car and looking through the rear view mirror, right? So that's one big problem that I have with simply relying on the data. The other problem I have is that you've got to believe that these really smart computer scientists and economists and mathematicians have designed financial models or have coded these algorithms to interpret that data, that historical data, so that the output is accurate and reflects reality. And, you know, that's a big assumption. I personally am not yet convinced that we figured it out. Mm. I alluded to earlier that, you know, we're only now starting to, you know, solve for poker. Mm. And, I'm not at the point where I believe that as smart as we are, that we've solved for an accurate prediction of a company's financials going forward, much less the U.S. economy, much less the global economy. I mean, these are very, very complicated systems. Mm. And, you know, maybe, you know, other people, reasonable people will disagree about this, but I certainly am not, I'm not ready to relinquish the Earth's defenses to Skynet, to use a Terminator analogy at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. And much less markets, which you didn't even mention. The markets are bring other variables into this. But you get to the crux of what is actually very much the raison d'être, to get into a little French here for you, of this podcast, which is the fact that information is imperfect and that you can't model human behavior. And that and a lot of these things that these models, the main one that these models seem to be getting wrong, well, there's probably several, but one of them is, the fact that you can't really account for these base human emotions of fear and greed, and how humans are going, or even machines are going to react when those inputs are at maximum levels, as we've seen here most recently with this whole COVID thing. I'm curious also what you think about, and another thing you didn't mention, which in my studies and which is probably a lot more limited than yours, but the studies of risk models and of algorithmic models, another shortcoming is modeling liquidity. And all of these risk models seem to have as their input, they don't seem to factor for liquidity. At least they didn't historically. Maybe they do now. But remember that liquidity dries up very quickly. And once there's fear, a lot of fear, that's gone. And again, for whatever reason, and correct me if I'm wrong, none of these models seem to really adjust for that. They seem to assume that there's perfect liquidity going in and perfect liquidity going out, and that you'll be able to get in and out of these positions at such and such levels. Is that an accurate assumption, you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to generalize. I mean, obviously, there are proprietary models, and every hedge fund will say that they've got their secret sauce. And, I'm open to the idea that maybe some fund managers say that they've coded liquidity into it. I think it's an excellent point, though. I mean, if you look at one model that everybody pretty much unanimously agrees on, it's the modern portfolio theory. Mm. And, you know, that model and the math behind that model is driving the risk parity strategies. And certainly to my knowledge, again, I don't know specifically, you know, some of these, the biggest hedge funds in the world use risk parity. They don't disclose the exact models. That's an unknown. But I'll tell you, it's a fact that some of the biggest hedge funds in the world lost a lot of money during COVID-19 when liquidity dried up. Mm. So either they got it wrong, or they didn't account for it. And I think it's a reasonable people could probably surmise that that's not something that they really focused on. Mm. I think risk parity is a really interesting topic. And I know some reporters, some journalists have covered this, because some very, very well-known names, you know, have staked their reputations in the strategy.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but I don't think that enough has been written about this. Risk parity is something that at this point has even crept into retail investing. There are literally robo-advisors that are advertising this as a way to effectively diversify and reduce risk. So yeah, this is a big deal. I think that it's, to answer your question, I think it's fair to surmise that probably liquidity has not been modeled based on the results of the most sophisticated hedge funds. Yeah. And I suspect that the reason is that that's really difficult to model, which really reinforces the point. It's like, well, yeah, it's difficult to model. That doesn't mean it doesn't affect us, though. We still have to live with this risk. And we know that markets lock up. And just because it's difficult to model doesn't mean that we don't have to deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah, let's talk about risk parity. So we should probably start with, to the extent that we can, defining it. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, and here's my understanding of it on a very base level. It's basically this idea that you will, as a portfolio manager, move assets. Okay, basically you have a group of assets, call it, you know, something that's risk-free, call it bond, treasury bonds, right? Something that's high risk, you know, tech stocks, and then a couple things that are in between, you know, large caps or whatever. And my understanding is that when one of these are out of favor, the portfolio manager will go overweight into that asset class and underweight the others. So for example, in March, when again, it was all risk off, everything was risk off, and everybody was chasing treasuries, piling into treasuries, what the risk parity model would do would go into something a little more high risk, call it tech stocks, and underweight the treasury element. Is that basically right?
I think that's probably how it's implemented today in 2020 in a lot of funds. Again, I would just reiterate that every fund, you know, has their own flavor of this.
Yeah.
But I think that's generally right. The, you know, if we just go back to the beginning of it, you know, the basics of risk parity are even simpler than what you've just described. I think what you've described is an optimization of the risk parity strategy. But some very smart people, some very well-known people at a very well-known hedge fund actually initially popularized the risk parity strategy originally. They market this as an all-weather strategy, all-weather portfolio. And what they did originally is they took what was in vogue at the time, this was decades ago, and they tried to improve upon it. And so traditionally, in the investment management industry, the baseline was a traditional 60-40 portfolio, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Earlier, I mentioned the modern portfolio theory. They used a lot of the math and the assumptions and the implications of that theory and applied it to its logical conclusion. So the 60-40 portfolio, the traditional portfolio, has some really interesting characteristics. Although it's weighted nominally 60% stocks, 40% bonds, I think most people would agree that generally speaking, stocks are high risk, high reward. Bonds are low risk, lower reward. And I think most people would agree, and I think there are, again, economists who have won Nobel Prizes on this, but I think most people would also agree, as the Nobel Prize-winning economists have posited, that most people are risk-averse, that if you've got two securities and one's riskier, then you're going to have to compensate them more, give them more reward for them to invest in that security. So those are two, you know, seemingly pretty logical assumptions that we can make. What's really interesting is that the modern portfolio theory and the proponents of the risk parity strategy, and very importantly, they define risk as volatility. Mm. So volatility being, you know, the up and down, in my example, you know, of stocks, the up and down movements of bonds. And the idea is that when you combine stocks with bonds, because you're using volatility as your measure of risk, you can actually do something kind of interesting. You can combine stocks, which have one kind of risk profile, with bonds that are mathematically relatively uncorrelated, another math concept. You put them together, and kind of like offsetting sound waves, they reduce the overall volatility of the portfolio together. So in essence, the theory here is that you put them together and you're reducing risk, And yet over the long term, stocks and bonds, you're still going to get the long-term returns of those stocks and bonds. So you reduce risk while preserving your long-term returns. You essentially have given yourself a free lunch. And literally, when you look at the literature, that's what proponents of the modern portfolio theory and risk parity believe that they've done, that this is a free lunch. Sounds suspiciously to me like what the subprime mortgage crisis, when people bundled, investment bankers bundled a lot of crap together and then labeled them as AAA securities. But that's probably a topic for another day.
Yeah, but this all gets to you mentioned a free lunch, and this all gets to one of the major problems that I've always had with a lot of the hedge fund strategies, which is that I don't quite get how you can get reward without risk. And anybody who says otherwise, it sounds a little like snake oil. Like, how do you strip the risk out of the potential reward, unless you have inside information, right?
Right.
But that, so it's just kind of like, it's a bit of a fallacy, isn't it? I mean,
I think that's right. And, going back to, the story of the development of risk parity, I think that's exactly what is happening. I mean, that idea that you can get something for nothing is very alluring. And with risk parity in the modern portfolio theory, the idea, to just expand upon the story I was telling, initially the idea was, you combine 60-40 stock bonds, and the risk parity folks would say, hey, we could do better. You know what we can do? We can lever up the bond part of the portfolio. And by normalizing and making the risk equal between stocks and bonds, because again, we're measuring risk based on volatility, you can, vastly reduce your risk and still have your cake and eat it too. And then they took it further. And the idea was then, well, why stop with stocks? Why stop with stocks and bonds? Let's add gold, another mathematically relatively uncorrelated asset class. Let's add oil. Let's add, more recently, let's add crypto. And when you put together this whole portfolio of very mathematically relatively uncorrelated assets, the idea is that you're getting something for nothing. You're reducing risk through diversification, which everybody agrees with, that you want diversification, and you're getting the long-term returns of these asset classes. The problem is that it worked for a long time until it didn't.
Yeah.
And then in 2020, Q1, something happened that wasn't supposed to happen. In Q1 of 2020, domestic stocks, foreign stocks, fixed income, oil, gold, real estate, crypto, they all crashed at the same time. So contrary to the underlying assumption that all these things were mathematically uncorrelated, they were correlated. And you call it a black swan event, and it probably was. But again, I think the underlying issue here is a severe over-reliance on these models that are mathematical in nature.
Yeah, and black swan event, fine. But we've seen this now twice in the last 12 years, right? And 2008, the fall of 2008 was no different. Every single asset, without exception, with one exception, sorry, which is treasuries, went sold off. Every single one. Gold, I remember looking at the Swiss franc. The Swiss franc sold off in the fourth quarter of 2008. So it's kind of, yeah. So it's like the whole idea of correlation. Once you have massive risk off, all correlation goes to one. And that just seems, and that's happened now twice within a generation. So to expect that these things are really the black swan events, maybe they are, maybe we're just unlucky. But if you go back, I'm sure that there's other times too where, something like this happened. But anyway, this is all very interesting. I want to take a short break, and let's ask you a little bit more about you personally, and then also the fund that you're managing now, which is not something that we've gotten into yet, because your fund has been, I know this, but you didn't tell me, but the fund has been very successful this year. I think it was up 35% or something. during, as we've said, one of the hardest trading environments in generations. So I want to come back and talk about that, but let's first take a short break. So in this space, normally we do, I have a pre-recorded thing that we play, but in light of the guest, Eric Chung, and the event that we are having on August 11th, which is this coming Tuesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, I wanted to take the opportunity to remind you of this event. Eric will be there. He will be one of the five guests that we have, all of whom are going to be unveiling exclusive stock picks. This is the third event that we've done. This is in partnership with Value Walk and Breakout Point. And the other two were very successful in that they moved markets in the stocks that were presented at the time. So can't promise or guarantee anything, of course, this time, but I'm certainly looking forward to, what I can guarantee is that it'll be interesting. And I'm really looking forward to having Eric and these other guys on and talking through those ideas. So to register for that event, you can go to contrarianpod.com/event. And now as a listener of the podcast, you get a 10% discount on tickets. Just enter the code contrarianpod at a promo code when you check out on Eventbrite. Okay, that out of the way. Eric, welcome back. This is the segment of the show where we typically ask the guests about their background and how they came to their current place, I guess. So what, so talk us through it. What was your, what's your career like been like to date?
So I'm probably the least likely hedge fund manager that you've had on the show. I'm not an ex-Wall Street professional. I didn't start my career at a hedge fund or an investment bank. In fact, by training, I was a corporate lawyer. I did the big law thing. Most recently, I was at the law firm of Simpson, Thatcher & Bartlett as a corporate lawyer there. And then I went in-house and served as the general counsel for a large consulting firm called Protivity. The way that I got into investing is unique. I essentially was very disappointed with the performance of my financial advisor. I, like a lot of lawyers, you know, I was 100% focused on the practice of law. And I basically delegated investing to what I thought were investment experts. I hired a large investment bank to help me. But like a lot of investors, they had a tough time outperforming, obviously, the S&P 500. But even they had a tough time outperforming mutual funds. Hmm. So basically, in a moment of frustration, after years of being underwhelmed, I decided to do it myself. And I remember this, and this was in the 90s. I went out and I read everything I could from the legendary 20th century investors, you know, starting with the, you know, Benjamin Graham, and then Philip Fisher, the letters of Warren Buffett. As a former attorney, I really, really loved Charlie Munger. He wrote a wonderful book called Almanac. And my all-time favorite would probably be Peter Lynch, the former superstar manager of the Fidelity Magellan Fund. And I started investing on my own and originally had no intention of doing it professionally, was just managing my own money, had very good success, market-beating success. But over time, what was really interesting is that I found that I was actually much more passionate about investment research and investment decision-making than I even was practicing law. So that's when I knew that it was time for a career shift.
And what is the strategy? Is it equities? Or?
It is. It's a long-short equity fund. I know that in 2020, these days, long-short equity can mean a lot of different things. But I would describe the strategy of Lighthaven as very similar to the strategy that long-short equity funds employed back in the original 1950s, 1960s, in the old days. So we are essentially applying two strategies with one, what I'll call, with one thing that I'll refer to as an overlay. So we are long and we're short, and we also have a fairly unique hedging strategy. So the long strategy is very much true to a value investment strategy. I would say it's probably, you know, 70% Peter Lynch, 30% Philip Fisher, very true to the growth at a reasonable price methodology. So that's our long strategy. We're very much fundamental long-term investors. And then on the short side, we're actually using the very same mental models, the same strategy, the same thinking, but instead of identifying companies that we think will be great long-term successes, try to identify companies that we think are being disrupted and potentially could go bankrupt. Hmm. So that's our core long-short strategy. We run a concentrated strategy, no more than 10 longs, no more than 10 shorts. We force ourselves, when we get to the 11th long or short, to take a hard look at our portfolio, to drop the weakest company from the portfolio, so that we're essentially always invested in our very best ideas.
Nice.
And then the overlay that I mentioned is that in addition, and we've been doing this more and more in the last 4 or 5 years, we are looking at external exogenous factors. So that can include macro, but it also includes political, geopolitical, and other factors that go beyond the classic, you know, fundamental analyses of just companies. And of course, it does include macroeconomics. Mm-hmm. And we, in times when we think that the market is about to decline, or there's, you know, a black swan event is on the horizon, we will hedge the fund. And we'll use, you know, we'll use it shorts of individual companies. We'll also short ETFs. So 2020 was a year when, I mean, we've been doing this successfully for several years, going back 4 or 5 years. But 2020 was a remarkable year. In the first quarter of 2020, we were probably one of the few hedge funds that took COVID-19 seriously. So we hedged the fund, and as a result, we had the best quarter. Q1 was the best quarter in the fund's history. Q2, the first half rather of the 2020 was actually the best half in the history of the fund. The fund was up 36% net of fees and expenses in the first half of 2020, and that's in large part due to the success of both the core long short strategy and also this hedging.
When did you decide to de-risk due to COVID? And what exactly did you do?
Yeah, for folks who are interested, we actually posted a video that was actually a trending video on LinkedIn about this.
Okay.
So Nate, I'll send you a link to it.
Cool, I'll put it in the show notes also, yeah.
Yeah, but we were fortunate in that a couple of things happened. For one, we have a very diversified global team. One of her analysts, she's studying in the United States, but is Chinese. And as early January, you know, she was sounding the alarm about COVID-19. Obviously, at the time, it was something that was happening mostly in China and then spread to places like Iran and Japan and Korea, subsequently, you know, Europe, Italy, et cetera. But at the time, it was largely an Italian, sorry, a Chinese focused phenomenon in Wuhan. But we clued into this pretty early, and we looked at the data, and the data was actually very alarming. So the World Health Organization, on a daily basis, was tracking infection rates and fatality rates, and the numbers, the data, was really shocking. Both infections and fatalities were increasing exponentially, and it was spreading to other countries clearly. And even as early as in January, there were indications and reported cases in the United States. Now, there weren't very many. I believe that they were, you know, travelers, you know, people who came from other parts of the country, probably from China, you know, in places like San Mateo and Chicago. But it, you know, we thought about this critically, and it was clear to me that based on the data and the fact that this was a medical issue, this wasn't, you know, this is not something that human beings at the time had the ability to influence, that this was going to be a problem here as it was in China, as it was in Italy and other places. And so we, you know, we watched, we prepared. We did an analysis of companies and industries that we thought would not do well during COVID-19. We also put together a shopping list of companies that we'd want to buy if there was a market collapse. And more importantly, we put together a list of companies that we'd want to short. Mm. And so in February, I remember this very well, there was a day when the market crashed and I think investors in the United States woke up to what we had been watching and seeing for weeks now. And I felt very confident that this was going to be bad for the markets, and wow, we took appropriate action.
Nice. Interesting. So what kind of other stuff do you watch? You mentioned your overlay and the macro and geopolitical things, besides the obvious, I guess economic indicators and such. What other type of things that go into that?
Yeah, as I mentioned at the outset, and I was very intentional about not just focusing on macroeconomics, we're looking at a lot of things that are external exogenous factors. So beyond macroeconomics, we're looking at, for example, political issues. This year in 2020 is an election year, and we're thinking about what impact a Biden presidency will have on the markets. Biden has already announced that he intends to increase taxes on corporations. So it's not a crazy assumption to believe that that's going to impact the bottom line of public companies. Also, through our research, we knew that when Trump was elected, he had replaced a lot of heads of administrative agencies reporting under the executive branch, EPA, immigration, all these different executive branch agencies basically took a much different approach to regulation, much lighter regulation than predecessors. Query whether if Biden is elected and the heads of these agencies are replaced, like the FCC, FDA, et cetera, whether that's going to result in a change. I think it's a fair assumption that it might. And beyond that, I'm looking at geopolitical things. Right now it's not as popularized in the United States as it is in Asia, but there is increasing tension in the South China Sea. Mm-hmm. The conflict between the United States and its allies in China. Currently, it's posturing. It's economic for sure. Obviously, the trade war is one example of that, but increasingly it's becoming military. These things are speculative in nature. We don't make decisions on wild speculation, but these are things that I'm watching. Mm. And then, as we've talked about, COVID-19, that's obviously a medical issue. Mm. That's not something that's macro or political or geopolitical, although it has it impacts those realms as well. But we're basically looking for other things that that could impact the markets broadly and severely, and trying to take prudent measures to protect our investors.
Mm. It does sound like you're saying that a Biden presidency would ultimately be bad for the markets, though.
Yeah, I think that, again, there may be compensating factors. There may be other things that he's announced or he will announce that will be good for the market, that actually increase the confidence in government, in the American economy. So I'm open to that. I will say, focusing on the two things that I've mentioned, that an increase in corporate taxes, that in isolation is going to probably hit earnings of public companies.
Sure.
Similarly, more regulation, I think it's generally would be, a reasonable person could argue it's better for the country, better for the citizens and society. But more regulation will probably result in higher compliance and legal and litigation costs, and just it slows down business. Mm. So I'm not taking a position on whether that's good
Sure.
or bad. I'm simply articulating and verbalizing something that I think most people would agree with, which is mm. more regulation will have a greater impact on companies.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to reiterate that it's, we can't just look at those two things. We've got to look at policies as a whole and make a reasoned determination. And as things go on, we'll be monitoring them.
Is there anything you think that the market is getting wrong right now as we record this on July 30th, 2020?
Yeah. To be, perfectly candid, I, again, for the second time in 2020, we did hedge the fund.
Mm.
So we are short a number of ETFs that track market indices. We're also we in Q2, we actually covered, and we were actually quite long for most of Q2. But a few weeks ago, I did short. And I'll be the first to say that, and this is becoming cliche, but we are in unprecedented times. Anybody who says they have a crystal ball and they know what's going to happen in the second half of Q2, I really think is overselling things. But I will say that the market right now does factor in, and it appears to express a very optimistic view of things. And I will say that I personally, for a lot of the reasons that I've articulated, I'm not in that camp. I think that I'm not pessimistic, but I don't think that we should, at least for the Lighthaven Fund, we are not 100% long and we're not super bullish right now. In fact, I would say that we're very cautious, cautiously optimistic. But I do believe that the market is not fully accounting for some of the things that could arise in Q2. And it may be an overstatement to say that the market's priced for perfection, but I do feel comfortable saying that the market is priced for a lot of optimism.
Interesting. And you say Q2. I think you mean H2, second half. Q2.
Oh, geez, that's right. Yeah,
I meant that's the second fine. Half. Yeah. All right. So, what exactly is it that you think we're missing on the risk side? I mean, you mentioned the potential Biden presidency. I guess that could potentially be one South China Sea, but that's always been there. I mean, yes, it is escalating for sure. But yeah.
Yeah. So I want to elaborate on the China situation. You're right. There has been, you know, the relationship with China hasn't always been good. You know, starting 2 years ago, the start of the U.S.-China trade war, there was tension. Of course, that's true. I think what's different in 2020 is that, you know, the hope that there'll be a speedy resolution to the trade war, that hope is highly unrealistic and low probability. At this point, with the Trump administration criticizing China's handling of Hong Kong, a number of U.S. allies, including the U.K. and Australia, similarly taking a fairly hard line against China, yeah, I think from China's perspective, the trade war is one consideration, but it's probably now dwarfed by their concerns about their standing in the world and meddling by other countries in what they perceive to be their internal matters. Mm. So I think, you know, we saw recently in the last few years how much the markets were impacted by the threat of the trade war. You know, with the current situation, you know, I put the odds of resolution in 2020 to the U.S.-China trade war at, you know, under 10%. Mm. So that's one thing that's changed in 2020. We mentioned the political situation and the what happens if potentially there's a change in the presidency. I also think that, you know, again, people have talked about this, but I don't think that there's been enough focus on the impact of COVID-19 on commercial real estate. So I'm in San Francisco, you're in New York, you know, there are companies obviously shutting down. I think that has been reported widely, but there is a widespread shift in the way that companies work. Even companies as large as Facebook and Google, again, I'm on the West Coast, so I have a bit of a tech bias, but those companies historically have had big offices, you know, in urban centers. Even, you know, companies like law firms and middle market companies, you know, co-working spaces. These are all are going to be impacted by the shift to remote work. Now, I can't quantify, nobody knows how big a shift that's going to be. But if hypothetically there is a crash in the real estate market, we've seen softening for sure, both in the commercial and residential markets. But a crash, you know, that's something that could be a catalyst for a broader market sell-off. And I think another thing that, you know, we're starting to see is we're starting to see an increasing number of bankruptcies. Mm-hmm. We're starting to see bankruptcies more and more, especially with the PPP payments ending. Again, there's a lot of uncertainty here. If the government is able to continue payments to lower wage workers, we may be able to avert a problem. But if that doesn't happen, and if you know, restaurants close and small businesses close, even large companies close. I think overall, some people may say that that's generally good for the economy. Then the stronger companies will grab market share. I could see that and I agree with that. But I guess the question in my mind is, at what point do layoffs and unemployment affect demand? Demand for the products and services for even successful companies, you know, like Apple, you know, will that impact people buying iPhones and Mac computers? I suspect if, you know, a lot of students, you know, can't find jobs, if lower income people go from being furloughed to permanently laid off, if whole industries, you know, portions of those industries shut down, at some point there's going to be an impact on demand. And then the final thing that I'll flag is that, and I think a lot of economists have mentioned this, is inflation. So one of the things that's buoyed the economy is the Federal Reserve and the government offering unlimited support. And I think it's the right thing to do. Obviously, you know, with the pandemic, the government should do what it can to help support the markets. But at what point does unlimited free money and just running the printing press in perpetuity result in unanticipated consequences, inflation being just one of them? And then I suppose a final thing that's related to what I just said is, obviously states, counties, cities, municipalities have all, you know, their revenues have been dramatically reduced and they've had to spend a lot more money on health issues and potentially with civil unrest on police and National Guard and things like that. I think that there's a risk of default of municipal bonds. Again, so far the federal government has stepped in and there's confidence that that won't happen, that the government will backstop and prevent those bankruptcies from happening. But again, it's not guaranteed, and that is a risk that I think we should be aware of.
Yeah, these are all excellent points. I wonder, do you know anything about Biden's, or if he's articulated anything yet on his policy towards China? Because the current administration has, just last week, to your point, it's already forgotten news now. You know, we had the tit-for-tat embassy closings, and then Pompeo made a speech, a very fiery speech, about China, like from the depths of like the Cold War, it sounded like. So it's not, this isn't a secret. It's out there that the current administration has a very, I also want to say, militant view of China. Whether that's justified is another thing for people to talk about. But do you know anything about Biden's views on China?
Yeah, you know, I'll be honest with you. It's pre-election. I heavily discount anything that Biden says, you know, before. I mean, the conventional wisdom is that if he's elected, things will more likely normalize with China. I think that is conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, and this is a potentially contrarian view. I think if Biden were to be elected, I mean, they're going to take a hard look at what the view of the American people is. And there's going to be a cost to reversing the policies. They're going to have to factor in, how does this impact our allies who have now lined up against China? In the UK, they have a different but related reason for lining against China. The Chinese have arguably broken the treaty with the United Kingdom over Hong Kong. Hong Kong was supposed to be, you know, self-governing for a couple more decades. And so, in my view, they're doing the right thing. They're offering Chinese Hong Kong citizens, you know, a path to getting UK residency. But, you know, query whether the United States will want to, you know, cozy up with China and risk alienating a major ally in Europe. Same thing in Australia, that's happening there. So this is a very complicated issue. I would just say that I'm a little bit skeptical of the conventional wisdom. I'm not sure, frankly, how Biden will react if and when he's elected. But I don't think it's clear as day, at least to me, that he'll be he'll patch things up and go and everything will be back to normal with China.
Yeah, good point. And you know, there is a point maybe that you can't put the toothpaste back into the tube there. And you know, based on a little bit of my research into this, there does appear to be bipartisan support or bipartisan animosity, maybe I'll say, to China, and especially in national security circles. So that's, I think that's very real. And you know, you also have this stuff over Huawei and things like that. But that's a fair point. Okay, maybe to brighten the mood here a tiny bit at the end, what are you a little more bullish on? Again, without giving away maybe individual names, which we're going to do on the August 11th event. But what are some signs for optimism and areas that you might be a little more bullish?
Yeah, that's a great question, Nate. And I just want to say at the outset that we spent a lot of time talking about exogenous factors, macroeconomics, political, geopolitical issues. I do want to be clear that the bread and butter and the core strategy of the fund and my investment philosophy is doing fundamental research and investing in companies, specific securities. So we do pay attention to stuff. It is an overlay, but we've made most of our money just doing basic blocking and tackling, investing in great companies, shorting bad companies. So to answer your question, you know, we continue to be net long. We've got a long shopping list of companies that we're interested in. A few things that I'll highlight that I think are continuing to do well and will in the future. I continue to be very, very positive on cloud and software as a service. I know that this is hardly a contrarian view, but being in Silicon Valley, and I know firsthand how every company, including ours, every type of software is going in this direction, and there are all sorts of companies that are offering new generations of SaaS services for everything from, you know, billing to sales, CRM, to managing property. I mean, everything's going SaaS. That trend is going to continue, in my opinion. The other thing that, again, a lot of people on the West Coast are keenly aware of is that there's a major shift in media and how people spend their time. So the dominance of companies like Netflix and Spotify, video game companies, you know, at Lighthaven, we tend to focus initially on products and services first. That's how we look for and find our best ideas. And we see that kids and young people are continuing to spend an increasing part of their day, you know, streaming music, streaming videos, playing video games, watching streamed movies and television. And they're spending less time doing things that previous generations did. I have a 10-year-old, and I know very well that, you know, video games is such a massive part of his life, to the point where, you know, even it's changing the shape of sports. You know, esports is now big money. There are superstars on YouTube who are live streaming their games, and they're winning millions of dollars, and in some cases, tens of millions of dollars, competing in online tournaments and competitions, playing games like Fortnite. And, you know, those companies in turn are making a lot of money selling digital assets. Mm-hmm. They're not physical things. They're selling dances and uniforms and skins and add-ons, really taking the freemium software model to its logical conclusion. So these are trends that are here to stay. And I think there are things that we should all watch as investors. Mm.
Good. That's a good way to close, I think. An interesting point there as well. Okay, Eric Chung, maybe in closing, let our listeners know where to find more about you. I don't see you very much on Twitter, do I? I don't think.
We do have a Twitter feed. I'll send you the link. We are much more active on LinkedIn. Mm. So that's our primary thing. We have a YouTube channel, and obviously we have a lot of information on our website. We are actually one of the first long short equity funds to file with the SEC to do a general solicitation. So we have quite a bit of information, including our full track record at lighthavencapital.com.
Oh, that's really interesting. Okay. Did you file the Jobs Act thing? Or did you do that?
That's right. Right.
Okay.
In our Form D, we check the box to be for 506C.
Okay. I remember there a lot of noise around that when that started, and then kind of didn't hear about it again for a while, but that's good to hear. Okay. Very cool. All right. Well, awesome. Eric Chung, thank you so much for coming on the Contrarian Investor Podcast. Thank you all for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time. Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.